Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA. Designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries, beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space MBA.
A NASA nominee's second shot and mimicking space environments here on Earth. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. After pulling his nomination earlier this year, the Trump administration has once again nominated Jared Isaacman, tech entrepreneur and private astronaut, as NASA's next administrator. So what changed? And what could the future of NASA look like under Isaacman's leadership? We'll speak with Main Engine Cutoff's Anthony Colangelo about NASA's future under new leadership. Then, how do we prepare to send humans off our planet? Well, one way is with analog missions that mimic environments like the Moon and Mars, but here on Earth. And just last month, over 200 participants around the globe joined together to perform the world's largest analog mission. We'll speak with Annika Milas about the mission and all 16 habitats. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Earlier this year, the Trump administration nominated tech entrepreneur and private astronaut Jared Isaacman to the role of NASA administrator, but then abruptly pulled his nomination. Now, several months later, while the Department of Transportation's Sean Duffy was fulfilling the role of acting administrator at the space agency, President Trump once again nominated Isaacman for the permanent role. The nomination comes amid uncertainty at the space agency, as NASA faces a dwindling federal workforce and proposed budget cuts. So what would the future of NASA look like under Isaacman, and what kind of support does he have for the role? Well, here to talk more about the nomination is Anthony Colangelo. He's the host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff. Anthony, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
It's so good to be back.
Yeah, someone who else who's probably saying good to be back is the new NASA administrator nominee once again, Jared Isaacman. Take us back, Anthony. What happened?
If only I knew all the ins and outs. But late last year, early December, I think it was, when it came out that Jared Isaacman is being nominated as NASA administrator, seemed to go well. He had a good hearing in Congress, huge support from the space community generally, a really well-liked individual across political spectrum as well, right? You had past people in Democratic administrations talking about how he would be a great fit for NASA. So he's really well-liked across the industry. And then politics happened. There's been a lot of theories as to what exactly happened, but this was around the time period when Elon Musk and Donald Trump had a falling out. And in May, his nomination was pulled. And then Secretary Sean Duffy, who is the head of the Department of Transportation, was named as acting administrator of NASA. He's been running the show for a little while, becoming increasingly public and visible with that interim title. So there's been a lot of thought of that. Duffy has been using this as a way to raise his political influence and his visibility on TV, and that he really likes the job, wanted to stay around as NASA administrator, kind of started lobbying to drop the interim from his title and just be administrator of NASA and the head of the Department of Transportation. But then it started coming out that Jared Isaacman had a couple meetings with Trump. He was back in the orbit, and it seemed likely like he was going to get renominated, and that came to pass. He's now been officially renominated, and it looks like he's got a good runway to actually being confirmed.
Let's go back to the time that Sean Duffy was that interim NASA administrator. Were there any substantial changes or policy initiatives that happened under Duffy that we maybe have to think about going into a new administrator?
Yeah, on the one front of actions that happened that are likely to stick, there was a change that he signed in as NASA policy around commercial space stations. Previously, the idea with the post-ISS, once the International Space Station is deorbited, what are we going to do on commercial space stations? The model had been very ISS-like in that it was going to be long-duration crew missions, months at a time. And that really boxed in a certain set of those working on commercial space stations. They are working in an ISS model. Those are the ones likely to win those contracts. Sean Duffy signed a policy change from NASA that opened them up to short-duration missions, which would include a wider set of companies, those like Vast, who are rapidly approaching the time period where they may launch the first module of their space station. It's a free-flying space station, but it would only be able to host short-duration missions. So this change effectively brought them into the conversation. And I think that's an area that I've been very critical of NASA of being indecisive on and not really putting a lot behind this commercial space station effort. Now, there is some reporting that in the month that has gone by since that policy change was signed, that maybe they would go back on that and say, actually, we do want long duration missions. But the idea here is that there was a commercial space station policy change that was significant. The other thing that is now the current crop of drama is that Sean Duffy started talking about how SpaceX is late on their milestones for the human landing system for the return to the moon, and how he was going to, quote, open up the contract, whatever that would necessarily mean, for their Artemis 3 mission that they are due to fly in a couple of years. He threw out this possibility that there may be a plan that NASA would look at to accelerate the timeline quicker than SpaceX would be ready to fly Starship, but to see if others out there would have something similar to fly on a sooner timeline. So would Blue Origin be able to have a Blue Moon-like landing system ready before Starship would be ready? Is the thing that the Duffy camp was pushing a government option, which would be a cost-plus contract to build a lunar lander in 30 months and fly it to the moon. Budget unstated, I would note, in all of this. The intent of this is to beat the now Chinese astronauts to the lunar surface, who look like they'll be ready to go in the 2030 timeframe. Or are we going to stick on the path that we're going, which is a more, hopefully, sustainable path that would allow us to do not just a single moon mission, but then build out an actual lunar base and an infrastructure there at the surface, unlike what we did in the Apollo days?
Those comments from Duffy prompted a pretty public SpaceX rebuttal, right?
If you could call it that. Yeah, you could call Elon Musk tweeting Sean Dummy a SpaceX rebuttal. Elon went on one of his tears on Twitter where he was kind of awoken about the moon. There was a lot of, you know, moon brain shown from the SpaceX leadership there, that they were talking about what they would do at the moon. What this could all result in is not necessarily that there's a better option than Starship, but it could just shake SpaceX a little bit and be like, what can we do to speed this up? Does this message sending change the way that they're looking at some things that they're going to do in the next year, try to make it go a little bit faster or simplify the architecture a little bit to pull in a year or two off their timeline based on what they currently are doing? That to me is the more likely option, that what results is some tweaks to the SpaceX plan than it would be a whole new moon lander that we would end up with.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Anthony Colangelo. He is the host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff. We're talking about the musical chairs game of NASA administrator that has been going on during this second Trump administration. We were talking about Duffy. We were talking about SpaceX. Now, Jared Isaacman's name is back in the conversation for nominee, and he is quite familiar with SpaceX itself, right? Flew on SpaceX, spaceflight participant, investor in SpaceX. How may that relationship change if he is confirmed?
You know, I don't know that it will change much. I think a thing that is often derisively said is like, he's just in it for SpaceX, right? And openly, he said that the space flights that he flew came from him trying to invest in SpaceX. Wanted to invest, but couldn't. There wasn't an opportunity to, but they did start up a conversation about flying on a mission. And the Polaris program that he set up, in many ways, I looked at that as kind of like a Lorenzo de' Medici patronage of SpaceX human spaceflight, right? Like, I want to incentivize you to go build these things that I think the world would be more interesting if you built them. I know you're going to need to build a spacesuit for your Mars missions. Let's go do a mission where I do a spacewalk, and that will help you develop in the spacesuit. So it's more of like a patronage situation that he's had with SpaceX. But if any other company was in the position that SpaceX was, he would have went up and knocked on Blue Origin's door, right? He's a guy that wants to see interesting things happen in space, and SpaceX is the preeminent player right now. So if there's another company that is doing something really interesting, I don't think Jared Isaacman would avoid knocking on their door and asking them that, right? And that's in his capacity as a private individual. When it comes to running NASA, I think it's that same inspiration that he wants to see the development of space. He wants to see NASA trying risky things and pushing the boundaries in ways that many of us have been critical over the past years that they have not been. You know, from talking to him, from listening to him, I don't think he's just in it for SpaceX. I think he's in it for who's going to push space ahead fastest. And the answer in the last 10 or 15 years has been SpaceX. So that's the answer to that question every time that you ask it.
At the start of our conversation, Anthony, you mentioned that, you know, Isaacman has the backing of the commercial space companies as a whole. What is it about Isaacman that sets him apart and has given him such widespread support throughout the industry?
One, I think he's just really nice and interesting. On the space policy front, he's openly talked a lot about how kind of embracing the new methodology of space, of embracing businesses that want to operate in space and what they're working on that NASA could leverage. Jared Isaacman has increasingly put this out there that like NASA should be doing the things that no one else is doing, but we should leverage the things the industry is doing. You've got imaging constellations out there like Planet and Black Sky, Maxar, I guess, I think that part of Maxar is still intact. Let's leverage those imaging capabilities rather than building billion-dollar assets that replace things that are being launched constantly by commercial companies. So he speaks a lot about embracing that. He's obviously an entrepreneur, so he thinks the same way that many of the founders of these companies think, and he approaches it from the same problem-solving methodology, and I think that is attractive to a lot of people in the industry.
He follows kind of a more recent line of, I hate to use this word, but unconventional NASA administrators, you know, starting back to Jim Bridenstine in the first Trump administration, you know, outside of NASA, politician. Then we move to, you know, Bill Nelson during Biden's term, and now both two politicians, both from outside of the agency, and now we're looking at an entrepreneur, you know, not even from the commercial space industry,
he's
but has, you know, some,
yeah, he's like from New Jersey. Yeah.
You know, are we going to see different changes to NASA as the administrations that are overseeing the agency change who they're putting in leadership here? What can we expect with someone else that could possibly shake up this paradigm?
I would only challenge your definition of unconventional on Bill Nelson front, as you know, I will grumble about, but it's a good and a bad thing, right? Because there's different instincts that he brings to the problems that they're being presented. There's different ways of thinking about it and not being so concerned with like the way it's always been done. And he doesn't have the same feel like, well, I can't do that decision because I know that center is going to be bad at me. He doesn't really care. He's a entrepreneur who's got a great life outside of NASA. So like, he doesn't need to protect anything with his future space policy ambitions in this role in the way that others, and I think Bridenstine is exhibiting this now, that like in his post-NASA career, he's out there for Jim Bridenstine and he's kind of buyable in some cases. Isaacman, you know, don't really get that. So he's not afraid to say, yeah, you know what, NASA should be doing X, Y, and Z, because he's not scared that that's going to make the other people mad at him or whatever. So I think he approached it from a different mindset and doesn't have those same constraints on him. But that also means that there's going to be a huge portion of the agency that doesn't buy into that methodology and is likely to not really go along with it or not be so enthused about it. Or maybe they do take any of these deferred retirement plans or whatever that is being offered because they're not really super into it in the new vein. Or maybe they're not supportive of it because they know that it's going to bring a shift in which centers are working on what, and they like working on SLS. They don't want to go work on nuclear propulsion. Does that impact his capability to go and actually make some of these changes? Probably. Is it worth giving a shot? In my perspective, I think it very much is.
Finally, Anthony, you kind of alluded to this, but you know, what challenges will Isaacman walk into? I mean, you know, has he indicated how he's going to tackle these challenges head on?
Not much. There's documents that are being leaked and thoughts that he's posting on Twitter and whatnot, but it's a really interesting map. So they've lost between 20 and 25% of the workforce by the end of this year, but they've ended up with the same budget. So that's a weird thing to consider how that plays out. I'm not so worried about what he's going to encounter on those fronts as much as I'm looking at the political calendar and I'm not seeing a lot of good capabilities here for someone to go and inflict a lot of change in NASA that they might want to see. So if Jared Isaacman is confirmed in the next couple of weeks, he may be in office before they have another budget due in the, you know, late winter, early spring time period. So maybe he can have some influence on that. But then he's into the midterms. And right after the midterms, we're in a completely open presidential election. So the presidential election, I hate to warn everybody, starts in about a year. Presidential election season that's going to kick off, right? He's going to be in an environment that is really hard politicking. Who knows what's going to happen in midterms? He may not have the congressional support that is there right now for the Republicans that, you know, he's part of the administration. And then it's going to be trying to get through big initiatives while everyone's campaigning for president. It kind of sounds like a nightmare to me. Maybe he's angling here. It reportedly is in tight with like the J.D. Vance wing of the Republican Party. Maybe he's saying, you know what, if I'm able to get this nomination, get confirmed, I could be the NASA administrator for 10 years. If this election goes J.D. Vance's way and he wins a re-election, I find that all very unlikely. But it's the first guy in a while that I'm like, oh, man, he actually could have a huge run here. And maybe he's looking more long term than what can I get done next year? He's saying, you know, could I be in this position to make change over the next decade?
Lots to keep an eye on. Glad we have you to chat about it. Anthony Colangelo is the host of the Main Engine Cutoff podcast. He's also the backup nominee to Jared Isaacman, is what I've been told.
I'm campaigning for it. Yeah, let me know.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Brennan.
Still to come, bringing the moon and Mars to Earth.
What analog missions are about is that they try to mimic or simulate conditions for future missions to moon, or in our case, Mars.
How analog missions help shape the future of real space exploration. That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
So Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA, designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries. Beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space-mba.
You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration from Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. What's happening in the skies? From meteor showers to bright constellations, there's a lot going on in the skies this winter, and all you need to do to observe it is look up. We'll talk about some of the cosmic observations you can see from your own backyard next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about something called analog missions. Just last month, hundreds of volunteers, scientists, and analog astronauts joined together to perform the world's biggest analog mission. It spread over 16 habitats across the globe, simulating both moon missions and Mars missions, all running at one time. The data collected could help prepare future space travelers on missions to our moon and the Red Planet. Here to talk about the world's biggest analog mission and to talk about her experience as an analog astronaut is Annika Melas, the Director of Operations at Mission Control for the world's biggest analog. Annika, welcome to Are We There Yet?
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we're here to talk about the world's biggest analog mission. But before we do that, let's kind of lay some groundwork here. What are analog missions and why are they so important to understanding human space exploration?
Analog is something that not many people are so familiar with. The first time I heard it several years back, I thought it was something like analog cheese, or is it something compared to digital? But what analog missions are about is that they try to mimic or simulate conditions for future missions to Moon, or in our case, Mars. And they work in analogy to conditions on Mars, for example. So it's not only that we use areas that are very remote and far away places, but also from a geological point of view, that they are shaped by wind and water, especially water. And then we go there and simulate Mars missions, collecting a lot of scientific data, doing a lot of research. And we also test technologies, workflows. We work with the time delay that is due to the big distance of Mars and Moon. And in the end, to make it short, we try to make mistakes because we figure out what can go wrong and what we still need to work on to prepare future missions. So nothing will go wrong then. Whoever saw The Martian, the movie, knows that a lot of things can go wrong and we want to figure out beforehand.
So these analog astronauts are doing the same things that Martian astronauts or moonbound astronauts would do just while here on Earth, right? They're
exactly.
Going out, they're collecting samples, they're collecting data, right?
Exactly. And of course, you can't simulate everything. We can't take away gravity, for example, to reduce it to 1/3 or something. But of course, you can check out how people behave if they are isolated for a long time. You can develop spacesuits. You can grow your own food and many other things. And that's what we're doing.
Annika, you just wrapped up the world's biggest analog mission that was at the end of October. First of all, where did the idea come from? And what did you hope to learn from this?
So up until now, a lot of different groups have done simulated Mars missions, but all of them only at one point in time and one place. Several years ago, during the Analog Astronaut Conference in Arizona at the Biosphere, some people got together and they thought that it would be a great idea to simulate what comes after the first people land on the moon or on Mars, or go back to the moon in that case. And I mean, if you forward maybe 50, 60 years, then you might have one group of people on the moon and maybe a spaceship in transit, and then you might have two or three groups on Mars. And compared to having just a single group, that would be way more complicated in terms of data transfer, communications, and so on. So the idea was to simulate that to some extent. And what we did now was we had 16 habitats from all over the world. So we had Australia, India, Kenya, Brazil, the US, Europe, and we had several of them simulating moon missions, some of them simulating Mars missions, and some transfer. And we were trying to figure out how to get all of that running together. And one other point is that if you do experiments, for example, on the ISS or the Chinese Space Station, you have 3 or maybe 6 astronauts doing the research at one time, which is a very small sample number. If you're a scientist, you know, that's not good numbers. So having several habitats at the same time, trying to enforce similar workflows and standards will give you a way higher number of astronauts doing the same research. So the results are way better to distribute them, to publish, and then to make them available to the space agencies to work with in the future.
Let me see if I get these numbers right. You had 16 habitats running at one time.
Exactly.
How many analog astronauts were taking part in this mission?
So one or two of the habitats had only 1 or 2 people, but most had 4 or up to 6 analog astronauts taking part. So times 16. There were a lot of people inside of the habitats. Then you have the mission support centers where you have a lot of people doing IT support, medical support, and so on. And then we had the MICO Vienna, which was like the coordination center of the coordination centers in Austria, where we had the data collected and transferred to the PIs, the scientists. We had a meteorology team that made weather forecasts for all the stations. And we also had the media team. And that were maybe 20, 30 people in Vienna. So all in all, if you sample in or take in also the scientists, I would say maybe 200 people or more.
Wow.
So it was a big endeavor, yeah.
You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Annika Melas, the Director of Operations at Mission Control for the world's biggest analog mission, about the largest analog mission ever performed and how mimicking space environments here on Earth will help prepare humanity for future space missions. Yeah, so you're really stress testing the system, right? This is you're looking for kinks in the armor, you know, weaknesses in how we currently do these missions. What did you find? And I know you're still parsing through the data, but what are some of the initial findings that you got from this this massive hundreds of people analog mission?
So I would say, for one, we realized even more than we already thought so before how difficult it is to streamline something like this. So the sheer size, the sheer number of people, the sheer number or amount of data, just like the file sizes and so on, that's a big, big thing. Then another factor was something like time zones. So we had several time zones on Earth, plus we simulated for 10 minutes time delay, one direction for written messages and also data transfer from Mars to Earth. And you can imagine then also during those 2 weeks, we had the summer winter change of the time. So that was just a big mess with all the time zones. But there were also, let's say, smaller things. For example, from the psychological point of view, if you do surveys where you look at how people's feelings evolve or how team dynamics work over the course of 2 weeks under those very confined, very stressful conditions, there's a lot of cultural differences as well. It might be expected, but also it might come as a surprise because all of them are highly trained professionals and you would expect them to be like a little bit like-minded, but some people might not even have, like from a cultural point of view, a lot of words for feelings. They might be more used to telling you how they feel, like from a medical point of view, telling you they have a stomach ache or something. And other cultures might talk a lot about feelings and might phrase bodily problems via telling you about how they feel like. So if you then take the same survey with different people and look at the results, you have to know this background to really interpret them correctly. To make a long story short, I would say that the human factor is a really big issue. And of course, all the technology has to work and that's very complex, but the human psyche is even more complex. And that's the big thing that we need to figure out and to be aware of if we want to send people to Mars, being away for several years on end under very difficult conditions. So that is the one thing that we still need to learn so much more about.
I find that part the most fascinating when we talk about these analog missions is the communication, the interpersonal relationships, how the crew actually gets along. it's a complex machine, the human body mm-hmm. and the human mind, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah.
So let's talk about what's next. Are you going to be doing another large scale one of these soon to answer some more of those questions?
I don't know yet. And I don't think anyone really knows because it has been really a big, big thing. And most people that were involved were doing it on a voluntary level. So next to their normal day jobs and so on. And there's still so much to do afterwards. The lessons learned process, for example, is a big part of the whole thing, because if you don't do that, then why do it, right? So you want to learn from it. So that needs to be collected and sifted through and published and so on. But I can imagine that maybe not on this big scale, but something smaller with several habitats will be done again, because I think it has a lot of advantages to just doing single missions. Again, a lot of let's say organizations and groups continue doing their own missions. So we have MDRS in Utah, for example, in the States. We have Lunaris in Poland. Also the ÖBF that I'm working for. We are going to do another mission in 27, the next big one in 28. So it really always depends on what you want to look at. Are you looking at specific workflows or specific technologies that you can test in 4 weeks in a desert with one group? Or are you looking at communication pathways and data transfer workflows that you can only figure out if you have several groups? So yes, I think there's going to be more missions like this, but maybe not next year.
Okay. Annika, you yourself are an analog astronaut. What has that experience been like?
Ooh, it has been a wild ride. So I would say 7, maybe 8 years ago, I saw a little newspaper article saying that the ÖBF was looking for new analog astronauts. And I Googled it. And that was a point in my life where I felt like, oh, it's time for new adventure. So I actually applied. And there was a very rigorous selection process. I didn't really expect to, you know, make it. But in the end, it worked out. So then I had several months worth of basic training. A lot of geology, first aid, planetology, night sky orientation, you name it, quad bike driving, diving, stuff like that. And then the Austrian Space Forum does big analog missions every 3 to 4 years, also on a voluntary basis. So I do have normal day jobs, several of them actually. But I have been to Israel, to the Negev Desert for 4 weeks several years back. And last year we were in Armenia in the high or in the mountains. I was a commander for a 4 week mission and now the WBA. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to what will come next.
Completely selfish question. How would someone like myself become an analog astronaut like you?
So actually there's a call out right this moment that the Austrian Space Forum is looking for a new class of analog astronauts. It's the first call since my class was selected. But unfortunately, it's only for European citizens or ESA member states. But there are other organizations. And as I said before, for example, MDRS in Utah, there you can apply. You can check out the university. Also, there's High Seas on Hawaii. I think it's not active right now, but I hope if they find funding again, they are going to continue. And there's several groups worldwide where you can just apply and maybe go on a university program. There's also some that you can just pay to do it. It's an up-and-coming business sector, I would also say. There's several ways of doing that.
So plenty of avenues for me, but in the here and now for our European listeners, there is a call out for them. Well, Annika, thank you so much for joining us.
That was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Annika Milas, Director of Operations and Mission Control for the world's biggest analog. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at @AWTYSpace. And if you've got an idea for a future episode of this show or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. We're at aretheyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.